Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Believe it or not, there was some other business in Washington this week. We'll talk about that. Plus, how has home ownership changed since the housing bust? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdal. It's Friday, November 15th. Good to have you with us. While the U.S. political system is in turmoil, there were plenty of reminders this week that the U.S. economy is holding pretty steady, thanks once again to the American consumer. We've got Soumaya Keynes with The Economist with me here in Washington and Lynette Lopez with Business Insider at our New York studio to discuss this and more. Hi, you two.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Soumaya, let's start with the hearings here in Washington. Yeah, not the ones everyone's talking about. Fed Chair Jay Powell testified in the House and Senate on the outlook for the American economy. What did you take away from those sessions?
I think the thing I took away was basically the same message that we got from after the last Fed meeting, right? And essentially it is that the bar for another interest rate cut is pretty high. The economy is sort of in the place that they were expecting. And if the economy starts going downhill, if you start to see a much worse outlook than they were expecting, then that could lead to another cut. But for now, it's kind of where they want it to be. Good consumer spending, okay, business investment is maybe a bit softer than they would want, but you know, the plan is going ahead as scheduled.
Yeah, and again, Lynette, this is more of the same story we've been hearing. Businesses aren't doing much investing. It's really American consumers who are fueling this economy. Any signs of that slowing down?
We've had some choppy numbers, like last month's retail sales numbers, or earlier this fall, they were not looking great, but we've got strong numbers today. And we've got, you know, we've got data that looks good. We've got data that looks weird. The Fed seems pretty confident. And I think one thing that Powell did in his hearings the last couple of days was speak a little bit more frankly than he had been speaking at hearings before, maybe because mm-hmm. the president was watching another hearing and he finally felt
he was
liberated. Yeah, he could just, you know, say what he wanted in peace. And one thing that he said, of course, was that trade was the thing that was really adding a lot of uncertainty to this economy, and which means that it's the president, it's the White House, who's adding uncertainty to this economy and kind of shaking the table.
One thing that caught my attention was how he talked about the economy kind of finally working for people at the bottom of the income ladder, you know, that the strongest wage gains have been for lower paid workers. You know, he acknowledged there are still gaps for people of color, people in rural communities. But Soumaya, are there more signs that the wealth is perhaps being shared more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, there's really good evidence that essentially hot economies are very good and disproportionately good for folks who are really on the margins of the labor market. So the unemployment rate will fall fastest for, African Americans in the kind of the hottest point of the recovery. And so that is really positive. I think one of the other things that Jay Powell said at the testimony was that, you know, that fiscal policy should you know, had more to do, that there were lots of reasons why people weren't in the labor force that really monetary policy couldn't actually help with. And my response to that was yes, that's true. You know, monetary policy is so blunt that it can't really help very much with people who are addicted to opioids or that kind of thing. But hot economies are very, very good for you know, poorer workers. And so, you know, one shouldn't forget that, right?
Yeah.
The responsibility to just kind of get the economy as hot as you responsibly can is still really important.
Well, what about that, Lynette? I mean, you mentioned the retail numbers that were out today, which were better than expected, but still, you know, only 0.3% growth. They're being sort of portrayed as a little good news, a little bad news. I mean, what kind of weaknesses do you see in that spending?
I mean, consumer, as long as businesses keep hiring at the same clip, the data to comb is the labor data to see if people are still hiring for the same amount of hours, if wages are still going up, are we still, and again, that's a lagging indicator, but I think that's what people are going to be watching. We're going to be watching if Americans have jobs. And of course, we're watching credit, you know, how much debt are Americans taking on? Can they still service that debt? If the Fed doesn't raise rates, that makes it easier. It looks like Powell's going to hold steady. So that's probably good for people who, you know, that is good for people who are, you know, have auto loans and home loans and stuff like that. So everyone's going to be watching that, and everybody's of course going to be watching the trade war. It seems like we're exactly where we were with that at the same time as it looks like we're in December 2018. You know, we're fighting with China for some kind of cessation of hostilities instead of drilling in on major issues. We may or may not have an auto tariff on our hands. You know, it's just the same story over and over again. And that isn't helping business investment. That isn't helping corporations. It's not helping small businesses. And it's a threat to the economy.
All right, we got to end there. Soumaya Keynes with The Economist, Lynette Lopez of Business Insider. Thank you both so much. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, you too.
On Wall Street today, traders went into the weekend on a high note. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One piece of the retail numbers that caught our collective eye today, furniture sales. They were down almost 1% last month, the biggest drop since December last year. And tariffs are a big part of the story. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more.
Last year, Beijing shipped $34 billion worth of furniture here, stuff like bedroom sets and couches. Those imports were hit with a 10% tax in September of 2018. That jumped to 25% in May. But Michael Spossi, an economics professor at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, says it's not just those direct tariffs hurting furniture sales.
Tariffs applied to an industry like metals, steel and aluminum tariffs affect the cost structure of the furniture industry.
To get around the tariffs, some furniture stores have changed where they get things made. Shipments of furniture from China to the U.S. fell by a third from September 2018 to September 2019, according to Panjiva, a company that tracks the flow of goods overseas. Shipments from Vietnam, where tariffs aren't imposed, increased by more than half. But Mark Schumacher with the Home Furnishings Association says changing your supply chain doesn't happen overnight.
Every retailer is different, but one thing is true for all of them is they can't pivot on a dime when it comes to, you know, to what they have available in their warehouses.
He says some retailers pass the tariffs on to consumers by hiking prices. And Bill McLaughlin, editor of the trade magazine Furniture Today, says everyone down the line has to be prepared for tighter margins.
If the retailer eats a percentage, if the manufacturer eats a percentage, by the time the product ultimately gets to the consumer, they're not seeing a significant increase.
He says the larger furniture outlets should be okay, but a mom-and-pop furniture store in rural Georgia might not be able to hold out. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We've got more on the news of the week. Sonic the Hedgehog, milk alternatives and robots, also recommendations from listeners like you. It's all in our Make Me Smart newsletter. Go to marketplace.org/newsletters to sign up. While impeachment hearings continued in the Longworth House office building today, President Trump announced some changes affecting the healthcare industry. A new rule will force hospitals to disclose the prices they charge insurers for things like drugs, medical supplies, and outpatient visits. These prices have long been negotiated in secret, showing up only on the patient's medical bills after a visit to the hospital. Here to tell us what this means for the industry and its patients is Reed Abelson. She covers the healthcare business for the New York Times. Hi, Reed.
Hi.
So how have prices for something like an MRI been set in the past?
In the past, it's almost impossible for someone to know the price of an MRI or any other healthcare service before actually getting it. Hospitals usually negotiate privately their rates with the insurers, and neither the hospitals nor the insurers want to make it public. And you only find out what it costs when they send you the bill or an explanation of benefits at the end of the visit.
Right, which can sometimes be a kind of a jaw-dropping moment for a lot of us.
Exactly.
And so how would this rule change that?
So this rule takes a fairly dramatic step, requiring hospitals to tell the public their charges, the negotiated discounts they reach with insurers, sort of a high discount, a low discount, and also even, you know, what it would cost if you came in and paid cash. It is supposed to go into effect in 2021, although there's a lot of expectation that the hospitals will push back and challenge it in court.
How would consumers be able to look up and compare prices?
My guess is, and the hope would be, that technology companies and others would develop apps. So you might say, gee, I need an MRI. There would be an app that would say, here are the five places, here are the five prices, and you would choose that way.
So the idea here is that if people have more information, they can shop around. And in theory, prices would go down?
Yes, that's definitely the theory for the folks who are in favor of this proposal. The hospitals insurer and insurers argue that actually prices might rise, because they say what will happen is that the low-priced hospital will look around and say, hey, we should have been charging more and increase their prices.
What do you make of that argument?
I don't think it's clear exactly what will happen. I think the fact that they're protecting their prices so much indicates that there will certainly be a narrowing of the price discrepancies, that more people will probably pay in the same range than are now.
How likely are people to shop around for a lot of these services? I mean, do people tend to compare hospitals, and would they be more inclined to do so if the prices are public, or are they going to go to the nearest place or the place that's been recommended?
I think it really depends on what kind of care you're getting. If you have a heart attack and you're in the ambulance, you're not going to, you know, be looking at your iPhone to see, you know, which emergency room is cheapest. But I think it is fair to say that you may want to look around, especially, quite frankly, if you have a high deductible. So I think the fact that you may have this information could, in fact, mean you're more likely to sort of shop around.
Now, as you mentioned, the hospital rule isn't scheduled to take effect till 2021. This is likely to be tied up in the courts for a long time. How long before you think customers will actually see any difference?
I think that's a really good question, and I don't know what the answer is. I think it could signal at least real unhappiness with the way prices are so secret now, and it could force hospitals to try and start making more information public so that they can maybe prevent regulation.
Reed Abelson, covering healthcare for the New York Times. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up,
8 million Americans lost their homes. And what I wanted to find out was who got them.
The losers and winners of the foreclosure crisis. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 222 points, 0.8%, to close just above 28,000, a new high. The NASDAQ gained 61 points, 0.7%, to finish at 8,540. The S&P 500 was up 23 points, again, 0.7%, to end at 3,120. For the week, the Dow rose 1.2%, the S&P 500 improved 0.9%, and the NASDAQ was up less than 0.6%. NVIDIA dropped 2.6%. The chipmaker posted higher-than-expected earnings and profit, but said its gaming chip sales would likely be affected by seasonal weakness in the current quarter. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.83%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Recode has a new tech news podcast out now called Reset. It's hosted by Arielle Zuem Ross, former science reporter for The Verge and the first climate change correspondent on American Nightly TV News for Vice News Tonight. Every Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday, Arielle will explore the unexpected ways technology impacts our everyday lives and how tech is fundamentally changing our humanity. From authors using artificial intelligence to write novels to biohackers altering their own DNA and hate groups using cryptocurrency to fund terrorism. These days, every story is a tech story, and Reset is going to show you why. The first episode of Reset is available now. Subscribe to Reset for free on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. The good news, bad news in retail we talked about up top tells you a lot about how hard it can be to predict consumer behavior during a time of economic and trade uncertainty. That's the environment retail businesses are facing as they enter their busiest time of the year. So how do these companies decide how much extra help they need for the holiday season? And what happens if they get it wrong? From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that story.
Predicting just how big the holiday boom will be and hiring to meet that need is always challenging. This year in particular, companies have to deal with a lot of conflicting indicators, says Daniel Zhao, an economist with job site Glassdoor.
Between the trade war, consumer confidence, volatile economic news, and on top of that, there are these long-run trends like e-commerce.
And failing to strike the right balance can have big implications. Too few workers, and you can end up like UPS in 2017, with big delays and unhappy customers, which could hurt business.
A black eye for Brown, an unexpected surge in web sales caught them unprepared.
Hire too many people, and you can really cut into a company's bottom line, especially considering the demands of the tight labor market, says Andrew Challenger with outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas.
It's a very tough environment. The cost of hiring is going up significantly.
He says with unemployment near a 50-year low, companies are having to offer higher wages, deeper merchandise discounts, and more perks to attract seasonal workers. Despite those concerns, this year's holiday season is already looking pretty cheery for workers and employers, says Andrew Flowers, an economist with JobSite Indeed.
So it doesn't seem that this uncertainty is weighing down on retailers' employment demands.
He's seen a 13% increase in holiday job postings on Indeed, while federal job numbers showed an 18% jump in retail jobs last month compared to last year. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
One of the legacies of last decade's housing bust is the rise of the corporate landlord. When millions of Americans lost their homes to foreclosure, a lot of their houses were snapped up by large companies and investment funds. And some of the people who made money on those deals might be familiar to you, though in a different context. Aaron Glantz, an investigative journalist for Reveal, tells their story in his new book, Home Wreckers. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
So let's start with that title. Who are the home wreckers that you're writing about?
What I'm writing about here is the people who came in and made a killing when 8 million Americans lost everything after the housing bust. So I'm talking about Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross, Donald Trump's Commerce Secretary, Tom Barrack, the president's best friend, Steve Schwarzman, the chairman of Blackstone. all of these men, all close to Donald Trump, they are the people who made a killing after the housing bust. But I started working on this before Donald Trump was even elected. In 2016, I was looking at statistics that show that the homeownership rate in America had reached a 51-year low. So that it didn't just go down in 2008 and 2009 during the bust. It actually went down during every single year during the Obama presidency. You know, 8 million Americans lost their homes in the Great Recession. And what I wanted to find out was who got them. And that's what led me to the home wreckers.
Well, let's talk about one example. You tell the story of Sandy Jolly and how her family got caught up in a reverse mortgage scheme. A couple of the guys you mentioned ended up profiting off of their situation. What happened to Sandy?
Yeah, I mean, Sandy could have been any American. Her parents were typical working family. And when they got old, they saw this ad on TV for a reverse mortgage. This is the kind of mortgage where instead of you paying it off and owning your house at the end, they give you a relatively small sum of money sometimes and then add interest and fees month after month so that the loan gets bigger and bigger. And then when you die, the bank takes the house.
Who ended up profiting from that?
Well, I mean, we start with Steve Mnuchin, right? Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary. He was not running this bank when it made that reverse mortgage.
Right.
But the bank itself collapsed in 2008. And so Steve Mnuchin gets together with his group of friends and they take this bank off the government's hands. They pay the government nothing. And then the government agrees to subsidize them if they lose money foreclosing on people. So normally a bank shouldn't have any incentive to foreclose, but we made this deal with Mnuchin that if he foreclosed on a family like Sandy's, it didn't matter if he would lose money. We'd pick up to 90% of his losses. And my reporting revealed that we paid his group more than $1 billion in government subsidies. But he's not the only home wrecker who profited off of this house, as you mentioned.
Right. So the family loses the home after Sandy fought mightily to keep it. And then she finds she has a new landlord.
Right. And the new owner is Colfin AI 5 California LLC. That tracks back to Tom Barrack, Donald Trump's best friend. And Barrack's company not only bought Sandy's home through this shell company, he bought up more than 30,000 homes. And Sandy ends up paying more than $40,000 in rent to rent her old house back over the course of just 18 months.
You, of course, tried to talk to some of these people. You couldn't get Tom Barrack to answer your questions. But we do know that Barrack and Steve Mnuchin were saying that they were buying assets that nobody wanted and helping stabilize the economy. What's your response to that?
I mean, that is exactly their argument. They said that they were buying assets and the economy would have been worse off. I also interviewed people like Sheila Bair, who is the head of the FDIC. And she said even in retrospect, the government would have lost even more money if it hadn't given this bank away to Steve Mnuchin and subsidized his foreclosures. We need to understand that the government had other options besides this massive giveaway. During the Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt started a government-run bank. It saved 1 million homes. And in the end, when the bank finally wound down in the 50s, it had turned a profit. With the GI Bill after World War II, we helped 4 million American veterans buy homes, and we broke even. You contrast that to these massive giveaways that occurred over the past decade.
What's wrong with corporate ownership of single-family homes?
You know, well, they'll say that we're just providing options for people who want to rent, right?
Mm-hmm.
In America, the average homeowner is worth 100 times more than the average renter. And this is not because the average homeowner makes like 100 times more money. It's because most of us spend most of our money on essentials like healthcare and food and clothing that depreciate immediately into nothingness. And housing is the one thing where either it's going to be money that we spend and we build equity and security for our family, or it's going to go to our landlord. And so we've seen a big shift. There are now 3 million homes, single-family homes, and 10 million apartment units that are owned by shell companies. We have to ask ourselves that this is really the kind of system we want to live in. And do we want to have the opportunity for shared prosperity?
All right. Aaron Glantz, senior reporter at Reveal and author of the book Homewreckers. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We've got an excerpt of the book at marketplace.org. And this final note on the way out today, which could give you something to think about during your next office meeting. What if we viewed work meetings not as a chore or waste of time, but as a form of therapy? Researchers at the University of Malmo in Sweden looked into why the number of meetings in workplaces keeps growing when no one seems to like them. One theory, they give people a platform to show off their status, vent frustration, or be acknowledged by colleagues. As one professor put it to the BBC, people like to talk. We've got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 222 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ gained 61 points, 0.7%. And the S&P 500 was up 23 points, 0.7%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And I'm Amy Scott. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.